Hi everyone, it's Stu here, your dulcet-toned podcast host. Are you tired of ads interrupting your favourite true crime podcast? British Murders, of course. I mean, who needs a 60-second detour when you're in the midst of an immensely well-told story? The irony of this being an ad isn't lost on me, but I wanted to let you know that you can listen to British Murders completely ad-free by signing up for a Patreon membership. For as little as £3 per month, you'll get early access to ad-free episodes, as well as a heap of other benefits. I've got a fair few bonus episodes you can sink your teeth into, and every Monday I drop a new episode of the British Murders Weekly Journal. If you enjoy exclusive giveaways, my Patreon has those too. Head to patreon.com/britishmurders and choose either my OBE or KBE/DBE tier to rid yourself of those pesky adverts. Plus, you'll be helping support your favourite podcast so that I can offer you even more content going forward. I'd say that I'll shut up now, but you've got the rest of the episode to listen to. Back to you, Stu.
This podcast contains elements that may be alarming to some listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
You are now listening to British Murders, the True Crime Podcast.
Right then, I am here with Lucy Wade. Welcome to the podcast, Lucy. Thank you for your time this glorious late January morning. It's a bit lighter than normal. I don't know what it's like where you are. Where are you, Manchester?
I am. I'm in Manchester, so it is a bit grey, unfortunately, this morning, but par for the course.
It's not bad, just down the M62 on Leeds. We're all right here. It's a bit cloudy, but no, sometimes we're working on a morning in my office, and I'll have to have my little lamp on, and you think, I don't want to waste electricity at 10 in the morning, you know?
It's a little bit on all day.
It's a little bit weird. But anyway, I digress. So we're here to talk about your website, your podcast. You've got your little background and your T-shirt. So your website, let's talk about that. So the website first. Do you pronounce it Wydom?
I do.
Wydom.
I do.
Okay. I'll hand over to you. Tell me about Wydom.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, because somebody asked me the other day, do you pronounce it Wydom? It is. And I called the website You Don't Own Me. So obviously it's ydom.co.uk. And the name came about because I'd come up with another name and basically somebody told me it was crap. So I thought, fair enough. So I went back to the drawing board and had another thing.
What was that name? Tell me that one.
The original name, I think it was something like Dawn of an Era or something like that. And this friend just went, absolutely not. That's not going to work. So I was like, okay, fair enough. Take criticism. So it just came to me one day and I thought, You Don't Own Me, especially when you're talking about domestic abuse. I thought, that's a really good kind of generic name. It's not too female, not too, you know, it's not too much of anything that somebody's going to feel left out. And that was the whole point, was the website is aimed at everybody and anybody. So family and friends as well, work colleagues. Because I always say, you know, domestic abuse, it doesn't just affect a certain demographic. It's not just a certain area of society. It affects everybody, either directly and indirectly. So then the website kind of started to grow and I started doing some blogs and I thought, oh, I quite like this. And people were starting to kind of resonate with what I was saying. And I'd worked previously for a charity, a domestic abuse charity, and I got a lot of my inspiration from there, working with people. And the issue for me is you get your sort of 6 week support, you get your one-to-one counselling, you get all of that. And it's fantastic. You know, if you pick up the phone and look for support, it's there. The problem is once that funding, you know, you've had your 6 weeks, once that's gone, what do you do then? Because domestic abuse doesn't have an expiration date. It's not going to all of a sudden, like, you know, disappear and everything's going to be fine and your life's going to move on. So I wanted somewhere that was like a one-stop shop where anybody could go and find resources. And it's not intimidating. Somebody said that to me the other day, you know, you don't go on it and it feels like you're on some big kind of scary website that's going to tell you you've got to do this, you've got to do that. You know, it's just there as a kind of a means of support, but all year round, basically. So you can revisit things. It's almost like a re-referral. So if you don't feel that you need to actually go to a service, but you are, say, for example, in the middle of the night thinking, I don't know what to do, I don't know where to go, I don't know what, you know, to think, then you can go there and read something and it might just hope, or watch one of the podcasts and hopefully it might just validate your feelings and your experience, basically.
We spoke briefly in the green room, as it were, on yes. Zoom, before press record. And it's quite interesting, I hadn't thought about it, but looking at the website, it makes sense. So you wanted this to be something that
someone who is experiencing abuse could look at without fear of, say, their partner spotted it on their phone. It doesn't jump out as a resource, right? So how important was that in the website's design?
It was massively important. And I think because I'm always trying to think from the victim's perspective and think about what they've kind of entrusted with me over time when I've worked with victims and survivors. And it's very much a case of feeling safe, which sounds like a really obvious thing to say. But for a lot of people, you know, you don't feel safe once you've left the relationship. And a lot of people assume once you've left, that's the biggest stigma for me that I want to break down. So I specialize in the daytime in post-separation abuse as a consultant. So it's making it clear that abuse doesn't just stop at the door when you leave. You know, there's a lot that can keep going on. There's obviously stalking and harassment. There is pulling you through the family court system for years. There is, you know, the using your family and friends. There's all sorts of ways to keep that going. And I just thought it's really important, and especially with the podcast name, is to make it clear that this isn't something that's going to sort of stand out as going domestic abuse. You know, it's meant to make both the victim feel safe in the content that they know it's done in a quite relaxed way. It's not, you know, even though I'm a professional, at the same time, I want it to be like you're talking to your friend. So that's why I do the podcast the way I do. They're all very, very highly professional people. But whenever I record, I'll always say, yeah, we're just having a chat, because that's how it should be. It should be like that person can sit in on that chat and not feel intimidated, or that, you know, a lot of the time the self-worth is rock bottom. So I just wanted it to have that feeling that it's welcoming rather than, hey, look at this professional piece of work, basically.
Picked up on one thing there. Now, I've covered cases where people have been killed, and prior to that, they've experienced domestic abuse. So I'm always wanting to learn the correct terminology. I came under fire one time, and it was actually, I think it was in October, when I was trying to do the right thing by promoting what used to be Domestic Violence Awareness Month, right?
Yeah.
A few people reached out and said that's not actually the right terminology, because it's not always violent. So abuse is the correct way of doing it. You also mentioned the word victim, whereas some people prefer survivor. So if we just go back to the first point then, what is the common, I guess, misconception between domestic violence and abuse? What's the distinction, and what's the correct way to refer to it?
And it's a brilliant question, because it's one that seems to fly under the radar so much. And people kind of, I go into meetings and straight away, you know, they say DV. And as much as, yes, domestic violence is part of abuse, domestic abuse, I described this to somebody in America recently, because America very much call it domestic violence. They haven't kind of jumped on board as much with domestic abuse. Whereas, so for example, here, the Domestic Abuse Act is called the Domestic Abuse Act 2021. It's not the Domestic Violence Act, if that makes sense. So it's a much broader term to say domestic abuse, because there's so many facets around abuse. It can be financial, it can be physical, it can be psychological, sexual, you know, and obviously physical. So there are so many elements to it. And I think that's where people kind of get lost in the idea that it did probably start out very much as domestic violence, because that's how it was kind of sold to society, that if you were in that kind of relationship, it was a physical problem that was going on. And the sad thing about that is so many victims and survivors will say, they never hit me. You know, they never did anything like that. They never hurt the children. They never hurt the dog, you know. And it doesn't have to be physical. Yes, many, many, many times. And especially, you know, when you get to kind of domestic homicide levels where, you know, there has been abuse that's built up. But more often than not, it is a combination of all those different elements that come into play, usually very much the financial, that, you know, you're restricted to what you can spend, the sexual in terms of rape, because often people think, well, you're married, it can't possibly be rape. You know, there's all these elements that come in that are so much broader than domestic violence. So that's where I would say the terminology really is, it's domestic abuse, and domestic violence can be part of the abuse.
It's amazing, isn't it, that just sort of, I think back to even the 80s, I think, rape of your wife wasn't illegal, right?
No.
That's still quite a recent thing, which just baffles me. I wonder if it's comparable with the stigma against mental health, because a lot of people are dubious when it comes to mental health because you can't see it. So I wonder if domestic violence was more prominent because
you can see bruises, right? You can't see mental, emotional abuse.
Scarring.
Just bring it back to the survivors versus victims thing, because I've spoke to some people who don't mind the word victim. Some people prefer the word survivors. It's more empowering. What's your experience with those two?
So it's interesting because I'd written a blog a while ago, and ironically, it's kind of my second highest performing blog, especially on LinkedIn, with professionals. And obviously professionals can be victims and survivors themselves. You know, they're not exempt from it. Again, I always go back to that. It's not a certain demographic. And I'd written this blog talking about, and it's entitled Victim Survivor, What Comes Next? Because what you find a lot of the time in my experience with working with different people is that they don't want to be pigeonholed. They often on one day may feel like they're a victim. And then the following day, they can feel like they're surviving and they're thriving and things are getting better. And then all it takes is some form of trigger or some form of re-traumatization from contact, say, from the perpetrator. And then they feel pulled back right to being a victim again. So it's really, really hard to kind of say to somebody, do you feel this or do you feel that? I think when I wrote the blog, when I said what comes next, and I think one of the biggest elements of my website and one of the biggest pulls I've had in terms of the work that I do now and the professional work I do is because I base everything on being a human being. So what I've kind of said in that what comes next is in all those experiences, whether it during the victim phase, if you like, during the survivor phase, you're still a human being. And that's what's kind of been prevalent throughout. And because you're a human being, you get to decide. And it was such a simple kind of blog in a way, but it really resonated again, like I say, with people, because it was, I get to decide what I call myself. I might just want to call myself, you know, for example, for me, I'd want to say I'm Lucy Wade, or, you know, you'd want to say you're Stuart Blues. It doesn't matter. It's up to the person, for me, to make that distinction. And I think we do very much as society want to pigeonhole people, and we want to give them those labels, and we're very into labeling. And I just feel that it should be down to that. They've had so much taken away, and everything about domestic abuse is control and power. That's all the perpetrator ever wants, regardless of whether it's during the relationship, regardless of whether it's post-separation. They want to constantly retain power and control. And I think that if we allow the person, the individual, and I often use the word individual, then they get to decide. And I think that's where things would start to progress in the right direction. But it's each to their own. Some people enjoy, you know, the term and feel comfortable in the term saying, actually, I am a victim. And some people feel comfortable saying, I'm a survivor. And I think you've got to give it back to the individual to decide for themselves.
Talk to me about post-separation abuse. A lot of people listening who aren't experts in the area, myself included in that, the most common thing you probably hear from someone who's experiencing that is, we'll just leave them. So let's say they go through and miraculously they have the courage and they finally split up from their partner who's been abusive towards them. To the general person, you might think, well, that's it then. It ends there. Whereas there's an aftershock of that. You mentioned stalking, stuff like that. How much abuse actually occurs after the relationship has ended? Because I imagine whilst someone is with someone that they're abusing, there's the comfort there of, you've got the control, you've got the power, you're with them, you're living with them. But once that's removed, I would have thought that that would perhaps escalate their behavior. Am I right in thinking that?
100%. So one of the first episodes I recorded was with CEO of TDAS, which is Trafford Domestic Abuse Service. And that's where I worked with Sam Fisher. And one of the first things we say in that episode is this misconception that once you leave an abusive relationship, that's it, you know, done, dusted, over, you're safe, you're free. It's not like that at all. And 9 times out of 10, I would say it escalates massively. And especially if children are involved, then it can really escalate. There can be, children are used as pawns, they're used as chess pieces in a game. You know, there's a lot of difficulties over, say, drop-off pickups, that kind of thing. Because if you think a victim or a survivor is, or what comes next, if they're in a situation where they have to go and collect the children from the perpetrator can make it absolute hell on earth. You know, no, they don't want to go. No, they're getting changed. No, we're not in the house. They can really put that parent under so much pressure to be actually fearful of where their child is and not know where their child is. I think the escalation can come from the fact that all perpetrators, as I said before, that's all they crave is power and control. And once they feel like that power and control is being taken away from them, then they are going to, and very often they'll go to levels that you wouldn't expect. And I'll often say, you know, truth is stranger than fiction, as you well know, you know, it really is. And I think they will go to any level to try and keep that control over their victim, over, you know, the children, a lot of the time over the families. You know, the families have invested in this relationship, i.e. sometimes families, you know, they may have their inklings and their concerns that there is a problem with their son's daughter's partner. I did an episode recently with Nick Gazzard, and he created the Hollyguard app, which is an app that when you shake your phone, it can automatically contact an emergency contact for you that you've set up. And it's a brilliant app. And that was because his daughter ended a relationship with her partner, and the ex-partner murdered her. And it's coming up for, I think, the 10th anniversary for them. And, you know, he's so passionate about raising that awareness that just because you try and end a relationship, and they didn't have children, you know, so it just, it's very much case. I always say that as well. It's case by case scenario. You just never know. You never know. And that's the really frightening thing, is the uncertainty. You don't know what they're going to do, because they can be very unpredictable. They can be very predictable and they can be very textbook, but they can also be very unpredictable when they're not getting their own way. And that's when you have to be very careful. And that's, again, why I think the website is a really good resource, because the resources page is just full of various organizations that you can contact if you are worried and if you are scared. Because, again, that's the most daunting thing, is making that call for the first time, you know, picking up that phone. And very often with victims and survivors is admitting that there is something very, very wrong, because very often that relationship is normal to you, you know. And from the outside, people think, oh my God, why didn't they leave sooner? Why did they stay? Why did they do this? You don't know all the components as to why they didn't leave. It could be financial. They may have no money to leave. They may have nowhere to go. The perpetrator may have threatened to kill the children or themselves. You know, there's so many reasons. And that's why I'm very passionate about not judging and making it clear that the website isn't there in any kind of judgment. It is for people to be able to think, you know what, I am scared, I am worried, and I need some reassurance that I'm not going mad, basically.
Do you deal primarily with women? Do you see many men coming through and asking for help?
You do. And there's definitely more male refuges opening now across the country. That's becoming more commonplace. And, you know, as much as statistically, this is where you get in a pickle and people go, oh my God, but statistically, it does happen more to women than it does to men. However, the numbers for men are definitely on the rise. And I think that's probably because men find it quite difficult to go and ask for support. You know, again, as a society, to admit that you're in a situation where you feel vulnerable, you know, it can be very difficult. Maybe worry about you won't be able to see your children. And I did an episode with Mark Brooks, Mark Brooks OBE, and he's chairman of Mankind Initiative for male victims. And we did an episode about how things are starting to change. But again, you know, it is this misconception that only certain people are victims and survivors, and it can happen to anybody. I've done episodes with Age UK. You know, people will assume that because you've been in a marriage for 50, 60 years, you can't possibly have experienced abuse. But what if you've been experiencing abuse from the day you got married, because you didn't know back in the 50s that was abuse? That was how it was done. That's how you were treated as a woman or as a man. Very often in those situations, it is probably more the woman that is experiencing the abuse. And asking for help in your 70s, you know, it doesn't discriminate. It definitely, abuse does not discriminate. It doesn't care who it hurts and who it targets, basically.
It sounds like there's the potential then for people to be experiencing abuse without realizing it.
Absolutely.
I'm curious to know, and again, this is just coming from my naivete, but how subjective is abuse? Because just bringing it back to the violent side, that's quite clear and cut. Mm. And whenever it comes to mental or emotional abuse or health, it's always difficult for other people to see what's going on inside your head. I just wondered if there is a level of subjectivity at all. So if someone's experiencing something and they just see it as normal, they're not bothered about it, but someone else might think that's quite traumatizing.
Yeah.
So what's the discrepancy there between one person and the next?
So two things. One was, when you've said about mental health, very much that's what I want to change, that kind of idea that, you know, years ago we didn't talk about mental health, now we do. I would love to see that same shift with domestic abuse, that when you walk in a room and somebody asks you what you do for a living and you say, I'm a domestic abuse consultant, that they don't go, oh, okay, and then walk the other way as if like, doesn't affect me, don't look at me, it's not my problem. And it, and I'd love one day for people to go, oh, wow, that's really interesting. And, you know, would love to support and all those kind of things. But unfortunately, domestic abuse has that same stigma still, that mental health doesn't seem to have as much. It still does to a certain extent, mental health. Not all areas, obviously, are the same. But yeah, when it comes to kind of the subjectivity of it, I did an episode with a guy called Tony Blockley, and he is the head of criminology at Leeds Trinity University. And he'd been a police officer for years, worked on some really big cases. And we were talking about domestic homicide. And he was saying the difficulty is when you're looking at risk factors as a professional, when you go into an incident and there is something seriously, seriously gone on in that incident, and you're trying to explain to that individual, this is bad, but you know, when you do it in a way that you're not going to traumatize the person, how do you explain to somebody that something they've just experienced physically, mentally, however long it's been going on for, is actually your high risk? You know, you're really high risk. And for them, it's a case of, but this is normal to me. This is how she reacts. This is how he reacts all the time. You know, that's my norm. And I think that is one of the biggest challenges that any domestic abuse consultant, professional, whoever they are, faces, is convincing people that it is not normal. Because sadly, this is where you probably heard all the buzzwords that go around these days, which is great because it means it's talked about more, is trauma bonding, you know, love bombing, gaslighting, coercive control, all these terminologies we use now. And very much trauma bonding is the crux of it all. And the love bombing is the crux of it all, because the love bombing starts very, very early on. And very often perpetrators, any perpetrator or any victim I've supported, the perpetrator is always very charming, you know, to the outside world. It's kind of like, wow, how could you possibly ever think that this person could be anything other than this stand-up citizen, you know, this amazing person. And then that's when the love bombing starts. So the difficulty with kind of, like you say, the subjectivity is domestic abuse is very insidious, and it happens very slowly, very, very carefully over a long period of time. So in the beginning, there is that love bombing phase. And more often than not, victims may not have the best self-worth or self-esteem, and they will absolutely love the attention that they're receiving. Why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you love it when someone's showering you with affection? But it's actually not affection. It is that beginning and that slow eroding of yourself. And it is making sure that you know that, you know, they're in control and they're in charge. And then over time, the trauma bond starts. So what you'll often hear is very, very common in domestic abuse cases is they've been isolated from their family and friends. It might be that the perpetrator is insured for whatever reason, they have to move from the area. So that means then the victim may have to leave their family and friends behind, or they may stay in the area but just not be allowed to speak to them. There'll be excuses as to why they can't come around to the house, or you can't go out for coffee with them. There's so many examples, unfortunately. You know, again, like I say, the financial, that can start off very slowly. I'll take care of everything, don't worry. And then over time, you start to realize actually what they're doing is draining all the finances, and you end up in some cases homeless with absolutely nothing because they have coerced you into trusting them. And that's a big part of it is, why would, again, another blog I wrote was, when people say, how do you kind of end domestic abuse? How do you, you know, prevent people from entering these relationships? You can't, because how do you prevent somebody from having feelings for somebody else? You can't. You know, if somebody has that bond and it starts to get stronger and stronger, and that you become normalized in that behavior. So the first time they call you a stupid effing idiot, or the first time something is thrown, or the first, you know, all these first times, what will happen is the perpetrator will then apologize, and then everything goes, you know, it's okay. Things are going all right, well for a while. And then with the trauma bond, what happens is the victim is always looking for that point where they can get back to the love, you know, where they were happy in the beginning. That's all they want, is to get back to that point. So the victim is stuck in this vicious cycle of wanting to get back to when they, well, what they thought was happiness. And actually all they're doing is, you know, allowing that perpetrator to continue the behavior, and then they'll apologize. And then if you do start to get to a point where you say, I can't take this anymore, I need, you know, the relationship has to end, they will very often threaten to kill themselves. As I said, if there's children, they may threaten to kill the children. They may threaten to kill you. you know, there's all these very, very scary, can't even imagine situations where what would you do if that was you? You know, would you say, okay, I'm still going? Would you take that risk? So I think that's the difficulty, is it's so insidious, it's so drip fed, and very often over a long period of time. And it's very often the family and friends I feel sorry for, because, as well as obviously the victim and survivor, is because they are bystanders, and what can they do? You know, they're watching somebody they love change before their eyes. But you have to be very careful as to how you approach your family member that is experiencing it, because what you can end up doing is, if you go in guns blazing, they could eventually turn around, because they're so trauma bonded, say, I'm not speaking to you now, because this is, you know, this is the life I've chosen, this is the person I want to be with. Or they could be so afraid of the perpetrator, like, no, I can't have you come around, can't have you talking like that in front of them. So we're going to have to kind of reduce the amount of time we see each other. It's so multifaceted. That's what is devastating. But also at the same time, there is that so much help out there. And it's hard to explain to people how much help there is, because it's not something in my mind that is promoted enough when we talk about abuse.
I'm interested in people's backgrounds. So not only the perpetrator, but go back to the love bombing thing and the trauma bonding, right? Do you notice any common themes regarding people that experience that? So I'm just curious as to, when a perpetrator sort of chooses someone to do that to, I'm wondering if certain people are more susceptible to it. Now, I'm not trying to blame, obviously, the victim here. Hope that doesn't come across that way. But I'm just wondering, because people that aren't willing to accept the love bombing and they're not going to trauma bond, the perpetrator's not going to stick with, right?
Mm.
So I'm just wondering if, in the background of people that you've spoken to and sort of liaised with, if you noticed any common themes between them, or am I just overthinking that?
No, it's a really good question, because I think, again, this is the difficulty with abuse. I've worked with people who are very highly professional, you know, are completely up there with, you know, managing directors. They can be all kinds of positions of what you would consider power. And this is where I think it gets very messy when you talk about abuse, is it, you can be somebody that has very little self-worth. You can also be somebody that comes across as very confident, but actually underneath you have very little self-worth or self-esteem. So you believe that this person has your best interests at heart. That's where it gets quite difficult, because I don't think there is a particular type of person that it's really obvious to the whole world that, oh, of course they were going to be a victim. Of course they were, because I think we all are very good sometimes at portraying ourselves. You know, I used to, when I used to go into meetings, when I used to work at Old Trafford Cricket Ground many years ago in my 20s, and I'd be shaking because it was all like, you know, Sky and BBC and everybody else. And I'd be so nervous. But that was how I felt internally. On the surface, I was confident as anything. I'm taking my notes and I'm doing everything I need to do. So I think we all can kind of fool the world in terms of how we come across. And I think that's really an interesting question, because I think if you spoke to every victim who, say, had had counselling, say, for example, or had had that one-to-one, there may be things in the past, there may be things where they felt rejected when they were younger. So they have ended up picking somebody or being with somebody that is, you know, seems to be more controlled than they are. There may be things from the past. It could be that somebody just genuinely falls for this person because they believe them to be a good person. That's the other side of a victim and survivor, is they're empaths more often than not. They see the good in everyone. And that's another thing that I find really difficult, when people will say, why do children want to see the perpetrator parent, whichever way round it is? And I've said this before, children love unconditionally, and victims very much in terms of adults as well, love unconditionally. That's their trait. So that's probably the thing that is quite a running theme, is being that empathetic person. So you want to believe the best in everybody. You want to believe that they are good, because I think deep down, we all inherently want to believe that people have some form of goodness in them. And I think that for children in particular, trying to tell them that they can't love somebody that is one of their parents is one of the most difficult things I think you'd ever have to do. And hopefully what you can do is support that child to understand that actually you can love both parents, but you don't have to respect or accept certain behaviours that parent displays. And that's a really tricky thing when it comes to children. And again, I've worked with children and young people, and they're just open books. They very often, without realizing it, are expressing how they're feeling. And that's a tough one when you're working with children, definitely.
Have you ever worked with perpetrators?
Well, this is an interesting one. There is a charity in Manchester, and they work with perpetrators, and they work with the perpetrator to try and kind of reestablish, help the perpetrator see that, you know, obviously what they've been doing is wrong. And I haven't worked with perpetrators myself. I've been very much on the working with the victims and survivors. But again, when do we know? In terms of walking down the street, I often think this, when the statistics go through my head, I think that person there could be a victim, or that person there could be a survivor, or that person there could be a perpetrator. And yeah, I've not myself worked with perpetrators, but I've worked with a charity that, you know, have done that kind of work. And yeah.
What's their results been regards rehabilitation then? Do you know?
It varies, to be honest. I think it really varies. I think it's a really difficult one, because how do you measure it? You know, is it by the fact that they are willing to try in the first place? I think it's a very difficult one when it comes to working with the perpetrator, because when we talk about coercive control as well, you can find that the perpetrator may come across as wanting to change. And especially when you're in the relationship, as I say, going back to the trauma bonding, it's, you know, I'll do anything for you to stay. I'll do whatever it takes, but it never lasts. Never, you know, it will always come back. In the experiences I've had, and from, I mean, there may be situations where perpetrators have been able to, you know, get the help they need, get the support they need, not want to behave in that way. But I think very often it usually is very much ingrained in them. There may be, and again, some victims I've worked with, the perpetrator's family, you know, we often talk about the victim's family, but the perpetrator's family very often is blind to what their child is doing, and they don't want to see it. And very often the parents may be perpetrators themselves. They may be enabling it. You know, they may be, they don't want to see that their child is controlling and coercive and physically violent and financially abusive. And that's where it gets difficult, because if you're growing up and you're, as you get older and you know, you think that, well, parents don't think there's anything wrong, and so I'm perfectly fine, that there's nothing wrong with me. And it is very hard to kind of, I think, I take my hat off to anybody that can work with perpetrators, because I think it would be a very interesting but very difficult way to support. And yeah, I don't know how they do it.
Yeah, you'd have to sort of put your judgments to one side.
Exactly it. You'd have to go in with a clean slate and listen and just non-judgment, and hope that, you know, if people do really genuinely want to help themselves, then that is possible. It'd be wonderful to think that, definitely.
The story will continue after these quick messages. And now, back to the story.
Let's talk a little bit about, how can I word it? I suppose time and consistency, because relationships have ups and downs, right? You're going to argue with your partner, it might be over something ridiculously simple, it could be a complex matter, it could be financial. You could easily go online after you've had an argument with your partner, Google the right search options, and boom, you're a victim of domestic abuse, right? How important is it therefore to use a website such as yours and speak to someone professional who can give you better advice, rather than just, it's like when you Google symptoms, right? Everyone thinks they're dying.
Yeah.
when you've just got a little cough. Do you know what I mean? It's a similar concept. So just talk to me about the importance of reaching out to someone and the correct channels.
Yeah. So I think when it comes to domestic abuse, it's an intimate partner situation that's occurring, and it is also a pattern of behavior. That's how it's defined. It's defined as a pattern of behavior. So, you know, it's not a one-off incident. It is something that has happened consistently, maybe, like I said before, with the trauma bonding, maybe periods where things get better and then obviously things get worse again. So it's important to know that if you are concerned that you may be in an abusive relationship, that you do talk to the right people, that you don't just Google it and think, oh, well, it's, I've looked and it says it's a pattern of behavior. Well, I've not experienced that, but you don't know, because when you're in it, you probably are experiencing that pattern of behavior. But in your mind, you're thinking, well, it only happened once, and then it didn't happen for 6 months, and then it didn't happen for another. You know, it can get to the point where there's no harm and no shame in asking, is what I'm experiencing domestic abuse? There is absolutely no shame in it. And I think one of the most daunting things anyone does, and I think I said this before, was to pick up the phone or to email, you know, to whatever it is you do to look for that support. But what is so important to know is whoever is on the other end of that, receiving that email, whoever is on the other end of that phone is so qualified and so passionate about what they're doing. Because I would say you don't go into a job where you talk about domestic abuse all day if you're not passionate about it, because it can be very sad. It can, you know, make you feel down at the end of the day. You can feel triggered if you've experienced it yourself and then you want to work in that area. And I think what's important to know is that the people that are on the other end of that phone, that are on the other end of that email, are there because they want to be and they want to help you in the best way they can. And they've been trained to understand that they need to be patient. You know, a lot of the time when you ring up, you might be stumbling over your words. You might not know what you want to say. You might not even be sure that it is abuse. So it's important to make it clear to people, I think, that if you do pick up that phone, that other person is sitting there patiently waiting. They are not going to, you know, say, well, no, I don't think it's this. They're going to let you get your, you know, feelings across, your experiences across, so you don't lose your thread, all that kind of thing. And then they'll point you in the right direction. That's the biggest thing. And signposting is huge. I mean, we don't have nearly enough of it. And, you know, especially kind of GP surgeries, hospitals, there should be things here. I know we have the Ask for Angela in pubs, but again, it should be something that's so obvious that you can go out and get that support. And I know, I think it's TSB. Somebody was telling me, I say TSB and HSBC have kind of safe spaces in their banks. So you can go in. And if you are concerned that, you know, you're in an abusive relationship, but you can't make the phone call from home, you can't make the phone call while you're with the perpetrator. If you're in the bank and then you've managed to go on your own for 5 minutes and they've gone to another shop, you can nip in at this room and you can go in, you can make a phone call, maybe make arrangements, whatever it is you need to do. But it is so difficult because very often the victim and survivor is just being watched constantly. And how do you then, you know, make those kind of choices and make those phone calls? A lot of the websites do have the exit button so you can exit quickly. Women's Aid, I know, do. I think Mankind Initiative might do. There's a lot of them and they do have these exit buttons where you can, you know, leave the site really quickly just in case, obviously, you're being watched. And I've suggested to people in the past using Cognito on your phone if you're trying to contact somebody so it doesn't come up as really obvious. I mean, it's a very sad situation to be in when you have to think almost in a way how the perpetrator thinks, you know, because if you're a victim of survival, you're not, that's not in your DNA to think like that, but you almost have to think the way they do to keep yourself safe. And it doesn't come naturally to a lot of people. So it is very difficult. And admitting it, I think that's the biggest difficulty is admitting to yourself that there is a problem. That is the hardest thing. But once you make that decision and once you know that what you're experiencing is 100% wrong, that's when things can start to change. But you can only do that. No one can tell you to do it. It doesn't matter how many people try and convince you that you're in this terrible relationship or try and, you know, insinuate because they don't want to say it because they don't want to fall out with you. It has to come from you. You have to know yourself that in your gut that there is something wrong. But I think if we did have more kind of posters, if we did have more out there signposting, I think it would make a massive difference. But again, slowly chipping away at things, and hopefully things like the website and the podcast will have that effect where people will feel that actually I can read something and I don't feel like I'm being judged, and actually I do want to get help and I totally understand where they're coming from. But you're right, yeah, never Google it. Never Google it. Don't do it.
Just come back to that point about Ask Angela. So what's that in the pub?
Yeah, it's very often, I think it's either behind the bar, you can go and ask for Angela, and the staff have been trained to know that that is a sign that you are in danger. So it may not necessarily be a domestically abusive situation. It might be somebody that's scaring the hell out of you in the bar and you just feel really uncomfortable and really unsafe. It could be that you are being followed by your perpetrator and it is domestic abuse. And I think they're in the toilets as well. In a lot of pubs, they have this Ask for Angela. And a lot of pubs sign up to it because basically it's a code, if you like, of saying, I'm in danger, I'm scared, I need help. And then they can help you and take you off, like say, to make the phone call or whatever it is you need to do. But again, Holly Guard's another really good one. As I said before, Nick Gazzard, he set that up. And I think it's either you can, when you shake the phone, if you've downloaded the app, you can appoint somebody as your emergency contact. You can put reports in there, because one of the very big ones with domestic abuse victims is they often either don't keep evidence, or the evidence is destroyed by the perpetrator if they find out, or you don't want to keep the evidence because you've convinced yourself that it isn't abuse.
And you might forget it, right? You might forget what's happened if you don't.
Exactly.
Know it now.
So the HollyGuard app is great because you can record kind of reports. I think you can send it to family members so they can hang on to it, so you're not hanging on to it. I did ask him as well, can family and friends log in and do the report? Because sometimes you don't want to do it yourself, but you might be able to talk it through and then get them to do it. There are so many things out there. There's a new app coming out called, I think it's out now, called the Flare app. And it started off, it's a guy called Gabriel. I don't know his other two co-founders, but I know Gabriel and met him, and he's a lovely guy. And that's to do with activists. That started out as kind of keeping activists and protesters, if you know, their feelings, worried they had this flare up. But then now he wants to progress that into more looking at kind of domestic abuse, you know, and all areas where somebody might need that support and be afraid. So to me, the more apps, the more ways of getting that help is so important. And I think we have something called Safe Spaces now as well, where you can, I know in Australia, they do, say, for example, like the Trafford Centre, there'll be somewhere in the Trafford Centre where you can go again and make those phone calls. And these public places where you can go and have access to a phone to, you know, so it's not your mobile, so it's not got a record of history of who you've spoken to. So it is slowly starting to change, but we're a long way off of it being something that is a conversation around a dinner table, shall we say.
Just for clarity, the Trafford Centre is not in Australia, although Lucy made it sound like it was.
You know what it is? What's it called? What's the one in Australia? David Jones. There you go. People know in Australia. It's called David Jones. I was trying to think what their big shopping centre was called. I couldn't think. David Jones, sorry.
Not Traff. Let's talk about the podcast then. So DIP In and Out with Lucy. You've got your background there in our little video. The DIP is an acronym. Discussion, Inclusion, Progression. So this has obviously come about on the back of your volunteer work, your charity work. You're in your third season now. Where do you see this going? What's your ultimate goal for this? Is it purely awareness? Are you hoping to speak to people? Have you got people on a list? How's it kind of going to progress?
Yeah, so, to be honest, I started it thinking, I haven't got a clue what I'm doing. I'm not going to lie. I probably still don't know what I'm doing, to be perfectly honest. But my reason for doing it, my reason for starting it was because the website, I thought, great, it's a really useful resource. However, what I was conscious of is anybody, including victims and survivors of abuse, they want choices of how they access information. So to me, somebody might get the website and go, brilliant blog, love it. It validates me. I resonate with that. I'm going to get support. However, some people like the visual, they like the audio, and they may take things. I know if I go for a walk, I don't listen to my own more often than not because it makes me cringe listening to myself. But I do listen to things. I do listen to podcasts. I do listen to, you know, motivational speeches and all that kind of thing. And I find that I probably take it in more. I'm definitely more kind of an audio person that would prefer to listen and go, ah, okay, pause, rewind, you know, that kind of thing. So I just wanted to give as many options as to how you accessed the information. And the blogs are slightly different because they're more kind of my interpretation and understanding, whereas the podcast is very much professionals from all walks of life in terms of domestic abuse. And they all give their very, you know, professional and valid opinion on their particular area of abuse. And I think the reason I kind of want to keep it going now, I didn't think I'd get this many people, I'm not going to lie. I didn't think this many people go, yeah, I'll do it. I keep seeming to pick people up as I go along, but I'll do one. So there's one coming out on Friday, and this she's called Maya, and she's just set up a charity around domestic abuse and abuse of animals, which again is something we don't think of very often, but very often, and as she will say in the episode, it's around if you are willing to abuse an animal, and very often a perpetrator will hurt the animal, they will hurt a human being. And it's just these links that I kind of never would have thought of myself. It's taken me down a road where I never thought I'd be speaking to people that had the level of understanding that I didn't even think of that aspect of it. So there's so many things and so many people out there that are willing to have that conversation. And yeah, for me, what I would love to see with the podcast is it's very much a free resource. That's what I wanted. So for me, it's on the website, it's on Spotify, I think, and it's on YouTube. And I just want it to be that free resource. And eventually I'd love to see kind of like councils and that kind of organization, you know, just putting it out there and having it in the directory so it's accessible. That's what I want it to be, as accessible as possible. So just to spread it as much of a free resource as is possible. And yeah, the dip in and out as well. I kind of did that because I thought, when you're talking about abuse, as you'll know, when you're talking about murder and you're talking about all these terrible, terrible things, is it can make you feel like, I can't listen to that whole thing. I might come back to it later. Or especially, I suppose, in abuse as well, you know, you can feel triggered. So I called it dip in and out. So you can dip in and out. You know, there's no structure to mine whatsoever. They're just, very often it's kind of like, do you want a conversation? Yep, let's have a conversation about it. And I think, again, that takes away the intimidation for the listener or the watcher, or, you know, because they know it's just two people having that conversation, but they also know that the individual that's come on as a guest is a professional and they know what they're talking about. So yeah, it's going well. I've had a children's author. She'd written a book, How to Support Children When It's Around Domestic Abuse. Yeah, lots of different ones and lots more to go, which is good. So we'll just keep going, keep plugging away and see what happens.
That's good. Do you do many talks? Like, obviously, we met at CrimeCon, right, in Glasgow last year. And are you going this year?
I'm going to London this year.
Yeah, I'm doing London.
Yes, yeah. We went to Glasgow. That's where we met. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to London, but I can't make Glasgow this year, unfortunately.
You did a talk in Glasgow, right? Did you do a little thing?
Yes, I was very, very lucky, or unlucky in my case, because I'm not very good. I'm fine like this, but put me in front of a room full of people, I'm like that. So I get a bit nervous. But yeah, I was given the opportunity very kindly to just talk a bit about what I'm doing and why I'm doing what I'm doing. And yeah, it was a really lovely experience, because it kind of validates for me what I'm doing is actually, you know, starting to make a difference. So yes, I do. I do talks. I've done a few. I'm definitely kind of building myself up more as to, you know, when I'm asked to do a presentation, I'm like that, oh my God, okay, yeah, fine. But then in my previous role, when I worked for the TDAS, I used to have to present to what's called the Local Partnership Board, and that's like about 50-odd people and very, very important people. So that was quite scary. But again, I think when you're passionate about what you're doing and you're passionate about what you're talking about, your nerves kind of take a bit of a sidestep, and you just remember why you're doing it. And in my head, a lot of the people I've worked with go through my head, and I think, this is why you're doing it. Just remember every person that you've helped and every person that's turned a corner, that's why you're doing it. And I basically say, I'll do anything to talk about abuse, apart from abseiling. I don't like heights.
Yeah,
I won't do that.
It helps when you know what you're on about, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Where does that passion come from, though? Because you've done your charity work, as I say, domestic abuse consultant. It doesn't seem like the kind of role someone would just do out of the blue. What sort of led you down this path?
I think when I volunteered for my own, charity TDAS, when I volunteered for them and saw the work that they were doing, and I am massively passionate about what they do. They're incredible. And I think for all of us, directly or indirectly, we've been impacted somewhere along the line, whether it's a friend that's experienced it, whether it's a family member, you know, there's always something there that is kind of the catalyst, I think. And when I realized that a lot of the people I work with and a lot of the victims and survivors that I supported were just, you know, just like me and you. And that kind of made me realize just how big a problem it is. And the sad thing about abuse is, and I will always say this, when I hear people use the word recovery, it makes me cringe, because so many people I've spoken to have said, please don't use that word. It's really, really like grates on my nerves, because you haven't got a cold. You're not recovering from a cold. It's not something that, you know, I've had the flu. All right, okay, I'm all right now. 6 weeks of intensive support and I'm fine. It's not like that. It is something that you live with day in, day out, and you learn to live with the repercussions. You learn to live with everything that's happened in the past. And I think it's, for me, it's just incredible watching human beings who have been put in such situations that you could never imagine and still managing to get up the next morning, you know, and get through the day and get the kids to school and do a day's work. That to me is phenomenal. And I'm just so passionate about raising that awareness and understanding that I would recognize a lot of the victims and survivors because they'd be in my local area. And it kind of gets in your head and you think, God, that really could just be anybody that's walking down the street. So when you start thinking on those levels and that scale of just how big a problem it is, I don't think I could not do the work, if that makes sense. It just is something that I feel massively passionate about. And yeah, volunteering was a big one. And then obviously being involved myself and working, doing some of the group facilitation was some of the best times I've had because they're just hilarious. And often you sort of think somebody outside would say, what's that group in there? Oh, you know, domestic abuse group. They're like, you're all laughing and joking, but you're still human beings. You know, you have a lot of times you find that people will say, oh, well, my situation was like this. My situation was like that. But actually, there's usually a common thread of some sort, and people will then connect and go, oh my God, yeah, I understand. And it's very intimidating to go in a room of people and talk about your feelings and talk about your experiences. But then when you kind of chip away at it and break down those barriers, you end up with people that stay friends for years. You know, they found their common bond. Sadly, it's abuse, but they found something that's a common bond. And I just think that's amazing. When you see that and you can see it coming and you can see it in those sessions, you're like, wow, that's amazing, because they found each other and maybe would have never known before and felt isolated and alone. So that's why it's important that we have all these support groups, why we have all the various support services out there, because they're so needed. Definitely.
It's an interesting point about basically living with it forever and a day, right? Because if you're going through something with someone, the trauma you experience, you are going to carry that. You're going to second guess almost. So if you get with a new partner who isn't abusive, that to you is going to be so foreign. And you're going to think, you know, if they go out of the way and do something for you, you're going to think, hang on a minute. What? That's weird. Why are you being weird? You know?
You know what? It's almost like you're reading my mind, because these are all the things I was going to talk about. I had a list in my head of what I was going to talk about, and you're hitting them all out of the park. Again, so had a conversation with somebody yesterday. She's called Carrie Bauer. She's the national lead, domestic abuse lead at Age UK. And we were chatting and we were talking about, you know, that conversation around, it isn't always that you go into another abusive relationship. Yes, people do. And it happens quite regularly. They will leave one abusive relationship and then go into another, and you'd think, well, how can they do that? But actually, if you don't have the support you need, if you don't have that understanding, and if you don't kind of know where to look for support, you will potentially fall into another relationship where that person, you might think that actually this person is protecting me, that other person was possessing me, but actually the protection isn't protection, it's possession. But to go back to what you were saying about healthy relationships, so the good news is you can have a healthy relationship after you've been in a domestically abusive situation. That is 100% possible, and it is within your grasp. And all I would say is, very often, if you do enter into a relationship in the very beginning, what we would suggest, say, when I work for the charity, is you are allowed to have boundaries. You know, you are allowed to say, I don't feel comfortable with that, or sorry, I can't make that today to go out this evening or whatever. Now, if that person turns around and says, well, screw you, whatever, I'm not interested, then you know that person isn't for you. If that person is understanding, and if that person, very much what I will say is, and this is what my dad used to say, was don't tell me, show me. It's fine, say what you like. And that's a good Manchester lad. Don't tell me, show me. So very often what a survivor or for me should be looking for is the actions of that person. So if that person is showing you that they are being understanding, then you are more likely to open up to them about what you've experienced. And you don't have to tell them everything in one go, because you might scare them off. No, you might scare yourself in how much you're sharing. So you don't have to share everything in one go. You can just start to slowly tell them what's been happening over time. And if they, as I often have said to victims, if they're worthy of you, then they will be patient and they will understand. And then over time, you can allow yourself to trust again. But again, there's no expiration date on that. You don't have to trust immediately. You don't have to trust in 6 months. You can take your time. And if it is a healthy relationship, it's a two-way street. So you know, over time, you'll have to learn to trust. They'll have to learn to trust you. But it can happen, definitely. And it's something that you don't have to ever think that you will never find, because you can find it, but you can find it on your own terms when you're ready don't rush.
Final point I want to talk about, it's something I've seen online recently. I don't know if it's a trend, it's a concerning one if it is. It's about this concept of trauma dumping.
I've heard about this. So what yeah, please explain it to me.
So my understanding of this is that people, and I don't know if it's just on apps like TikTok or whatever, but it's people that go on there and basically unleash all of their built-up trauma and essentially dump that on the viewer, which I guess unburdens them. But what interests me is people doing this in new relationships, because I wonder if you've been experiencing domestic abuse and you meet someone new, trauma dumping in that scenario, I think, would be telling them all of your skeletons in the closet, as it were, and then hoping that they accept you for that, rather than playing it a bit more cautiously and just getting to know them as you normally would, and then perhaps over time revealing stuff, you know? So I think, again, it seems like a bit of a weird trend at the minute where people are just going online and doing all this stuff.
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely. And now you've said it, I do think I've seen it a couple of times. I wasn't aware that that's what it was, but I'm getting old, so I just see things. If I like something, I like, and if I don't, I'm not the best on these things. Everyone laughs at me like, you're great on LinkedIn, but social media, you're just like, but it's a hard one for me, because you talk about abuse and a lot of people just go, yeah, I don't want to like that comment, or I don't want to like that. So yeah, I have seen a couple. And there's a few things there. One is, if you're somebody that's experienced abuse and you are watching one of those videos, that can absolutely have a massive impact on you, that you're not only trying to process your own feelings and your own experiences, you're also now taking on somebody else's when you're not necessarily at peace with what's happened to you and being able to move forward daily. So I'd be very conscious of watching anything like that. And I think social media in particular, be very, very mindful of what you're taking on board when you are trying to process what you've been through. If you have been through an abusive relationship and you're aware that you've been through an abusive relationship, just be very conscious that a lot of the time what you see on social media, just bear in mind it can be very damaging. And sometimes I've known some people who will completely go off social media if they've been through domestic abuse, because they want time to kind of deal with their own head, deal with their own emotions. And I don't actually think that's a bad thing. I think it's quite a good thing in some ways, because there's a lot on there where people will talk about their own lived experience, and that's fine. But it can also be very damaging for somebody who is trying to move forward with their life. So yeah, trauma dumping, it sounds like a very bizarre one to me. And also very selfish that somebody wants to give you all their trauma and all their worries. I'd say go and get some help myself. I'd say go and get signpost them to services. But again, going back to it, if you're in that relationship, I think it will come down to the individual as to whether they feel that they want to. You can't stop somebody if they want to say, I'm going to blurt this all out and tell you everything. There's a balance, I suppose. If you don't tell the person that you've started this relationship with what's going on, and there are little things maybe happening behind the scenes that they don't know about, they're going to be concerned that you're withholding things from them. And that's, you know, perfectly understandable. This person that's come into your life that cares about you doesn't know everything. And why are you not telling me? So it's a really careful line to tread, I think, where yes, talk about things, be conscious of what you're sharing, be comfortable with what you're sharing. And yeah, just try not to put it all on. And the first instance, I would say, I would take your time. Because the other thing is, as well as victims and survivors, they're still processing it. You know, if you imagine, like we've talked about before, if you didn't know for 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, however many years, 5 years, if you didn't know you were in an abusive relationship, you still have to process that yourself. And things will come back into your mind where it will be something, for example, I don't know, where something's been said and you go, oh my God, that was abuse. You know, oh my God, that was, and it can take years for people to process what has happened to them. And there will be things that have happened years in the past that will come back and kind of haunt them in a way, if you like. And then you've got family and friends who, now you're no longer in that relationship, feel it's okay to say, oh, well, I knew this and I thought that. So then you have to process all that. Oh, great. Well, you all knew, but nobody told me. You know, there's a lot for people to process. And I do think it isn't kind of talked about enough. I'm doing something soon with a well-being, and again, domestic abuse very much in with that wellbeing sector in terms of it can affect your mental health. Of course it can. Why wouldn't it? If someone's been playing psychological games for years, how could it not affect you mentally? And there's no shame in that either. There's absolutely no shame in getting the help that you need to work through that. But I think for two very small words, domestic abuse, there's a hell of a lot underneath that. It's like a big iceberg, isn't it? There's the little words at the top, and underneath is this horrible big iceberg to unpack, chip away at. There you go. That's a good one.
That's it. Well, Lucy, thanks for coming on. I think speaking about it in such a conversational way is beneficial because it takes away the stigma, the taboo that's associated with it, and people can just have an open conversation with free of judgment, which is the main thing. So thank you for that. I'm going to link your website in the show notes of this episode. So that's ydom.co.uk. That's sort of your one-stop resource, right? So rather than put a load of links in the show notes, I'm just going to link people to your site.
Perfect.
Now on,
thank you.
It makes my job easier, and it's a reliable resource. Also, check out the podcast Dip In and Out with Lucy. I'll put a link to that as well for you.
Oh, you're so good to me.
And if you want to see Lucy in person, CrimeCon this September in London, I'll also be there, but it's not about me. Lucy will be there, offers far more to the world than I do, I imagine. Oh. But I appreciate your time for coming on. Any final thoughts before we end it there?
No, just all I would say, if anybody does listen and thinks that potentially anything has made them think about their own lives, is don't feel any shame. Absolutely. Take it one day at a time and it can get better.
Good way to end. Hope everyone has found that beneficial and useful. And please do reach out. The website's there. Reach out. And even if you're not sure, it's better to ask, right?
Absolutely.
Put your mind 100%. At ease. Right. We'll leave it there. Thank you, everyone. Hope you enjoyed that. And I'll see you next time.